Hi, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
I know you're dying to be here at 10 a.m. in the morning after a gig. You want nothing better than to be here early in the morning.
It gives me a really great reason to give up. To give up?
To give up.
It gives me a reason to give up.
We were just talking about being maudlin, but oh my gosh. Now we know. See, but the things that come out.
I haven't had any coffee. That is a big fatal flaw for me. So.
And I haven't, and no one lets me. Would you introduce yourself, please? I forgot the most important part. Oh. See, people just say, oh, he's having yet another conversation.
Who's that girl?
Who's that girl?
My name's Angela Correa, and I have a band called Koreatown.
I've heard that. Is that why you're here?
That is why I'm here.
Not because we just met on the street and you said, hey, this sounds like a good guy to have a conversation with, so we'll just,
Well, I did think that in the hallway when I spotted you.
Behind some, microphones. I carry them with me. Usually we wait on these interviews until there are more than three songs. Now, technically, until I went on the MySpace site.
You only ever heard of three songs.
I only heard three songs tonight. Yeah. But however, there are indeed more than three songs. In fact, there are songs from back several years ago that people can go out of their way to discover because it's not easy to do so, I would imagine. Is Koreatown officially a band, a collective, or a group of thieves?
It's all of the above. No, I would say it is a...
Good.
A sort of... Koreatown's my project, and... I like the idea of a band only because I can do whatever I want with it. I can play with the friends that I do in Los Angeles. When I go to New York, I can play with some other friends. I can play solo if I want. But it is sort of, it's my thing. And so it is a collection of thieves and marauders.
When I told somebody this morning that I was going to interview you, they said, oh, and they, of course, went to L.A. They said, well, is that a play on Koreatown in L.A.? Or... And I said, well, the spelling's kind of different. And so I figure I'll ask that question because you are L.A. based, technically.
Yeah, I'm originally from Northern California, from Yuba City, which
is a
pretty small town.
I know where that is.
Orchards.
I've worked with somebody from there, yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's up north.
It's good, though. I like where I come from, but I do live in Los Angeles now, and I live in Echo Park on the east side. And so I'm actually, that's pretty close to my heart, being part of that east side scene. I had actually a friend who I wasn't related to who had the same last name as I did, and their family insisted on pronouncing it properly, which would be Correa, because it's Mexican-American originally. And I just thought, man, it's so much trouble. It's just everyone says Korea. It looks like Korea. Let's just say Korea. And so then when it came, I had friends who called me Koreatown as a joke all the time. It was, hey, Koreatown. And so I just sort of adopted that.
The first time that I heard you, the three-song EP really is quite a treat, even though it's only three songs. And, well, not counting that movie, which we'll get to in a little while, which technically was the first time I heard you, even though I didn't know it when I saw it. So now the question, you truly made this EP a homegrown project. You drew the art, you hand screen printed it, you used recycled paper sleeves, and once they're gone, in the words of Simon and Garfunkel, when they're gone, they're gone.
It's true. I really wanted to do something special for this. I have an entire album finished.
Right. That'll be the next question.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Well, and so I thought, I really wanted to put a couple of songs out into the world, and I wanted to do it in a really sort of special way that I'm really... attracted to art and doing things sort of in a slightly unusual manner. And I always seem to take that curvy road that takes a lot more time and effort than anybody else would have created for themselves. So
that concept.
Yeah. And
I do that on a daily basis.
I think it's worthwhile, though, because at the end of the day, you have something that you put a whole lot of time and energy into, and it makes a difference. Like, people, I don't know why, they look at the EPs and they go, wow, this is so cool, I love this artwork, and it feels kind of good to go, yeah, I made that in my living room and my friends helped me hot glue it together. And I don't know, it's just sort of the way I've always done things. I like to just do it myself if I can, and if I can't, then find people to help me.
Early EPs, there was one, I think, according to my research, in 2002, 04, 05, but those were even more homebrewed than these, and those have magically disappeared completely, right?
Well, there aren't any physical copies, and I sometimes will do like a little short run up of them, but they're just essentially CDRs, and I'll hand make the artwork, and that's what I did, when I'd go out on tour, whenever I'd play shows, I would just like cut and paste and glue and sew artwork together, and I don't know, people seem to like it, and it was fun for me. But
when you get big, it makes for so many great B-sides, right?
I guess.
You've got the material for the archival greatest hits collection, you know, for the second CD.
Yeah, maybe.
Ready to rock.
I don't know if anyone wants to hear those songs, but they are, you know, all available digitally now. And that's the really great thing. As an independent musician, you do have a distribution system available to you, and it's digital, and it's pretty much free, with the exception of like a small, you know, commission.
There's a full-length album. That one, you're not going to release, from what I hear, in a homegrown way. The hope is that it can find a home that can actually support it. And I heard a rumor, and I won't tell you where I heard that rumor, that there was at least one major label that was already snooping that you politely said, I don't really like the terms. Now, is that a rumor? Or
it wasn't a major label, but there have been some people poking around with some interest. And I've decided that I've done it my way this long, and I'm not going to do a deal that doesn't feel right to me, and I sort of have figured out.
So would that be the, we're not going to make sure you have this particular producer that we're going to bring to the studio on the second album because your first album was actually recorded well, and we want someone else to put enough reverb on it to kill?
Yeah. No, it's actually, well.
Or the album cover. Absolutely. You know, it has to be shot by Ignaz Schwartz, the famous photographer who, you know, has shot Madonna 25 times.
Yeah, I'm really not into that. I don't know. And I definitely wouldn't be into any sort of situation where someone was going to try and mandate creatively what I'm supposed to do and how I'm supposed to look and how it's supposed to sound. I think that's truly the point of having an artist and having them do something. I had a long conversation with someone who's been working in the industry for quite a long time. And honestly, when you think about it, as a songwriter, like, that's my 401k, like, my publishing and my royalties. Like, I've been working independently. I haven't had, you know, like, a lot of people in this country, unfortunately, health insurance for, like, 10 years since I was in college, you know, and or since I had, you know, access to a health clinic in college, rather. And I don't know, I don't think it's fair to ask someone to just give away everything that they've been spending all of their time creating. You wouldn't say to someone, well, I want to hire you, but I need to have your 401k plan, or at least part of it, for the next 15 years. So it doesn't sit well
with
me. People
don't equate rock and roll the same way that they equate normal jobs. You just did that there, but it's very true.
Yeah, it's totally true, because they don't realize, I think, that, you know, I've been working on these songs for years and years and years, and as somebody also who's working independently, I make my own albums, I put them out, I find a way to book tours, I write everything myself. I'm a one person show, gratefully, with a lot of new friends who help and support me, but it comes down to, like, every day, that's what I'm doing. I'm working on my business, which is like my music, and you don't want to really think of that. You don't want to like cross commercialism and art in that way, but it's true. Like,
but that's rock and
it's
roll.
My job,
good rock
know?
And roll is a combination of business and art. It just is.
Yeah, and I don't think
it always has been.
There's nothing really wrong with it when it comes down to it, and there's nothing wrong with taking responsibility for your life and what you want to do and being smart about it. If you wanted to, you know, have a job and whatever, some sort of crazy financial industry, you know, you would figure out what you need to do, find out what you needed to like take care of, you would take care of yourself. And as musicians, a lot of the time we're like, oh, that's cool, I just like write songs and play music.
Oh, this little homegrown EP sounds damn good.
Thank you.
You didn't decide to do the lo-fi thing. You had a co-producer in Raymond Richards.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that the very limited editions tracks from this are also going to magically appear on the full length. Would I be correct?
Yeah, I'm hoping.
You've got a couple of hits on there, so you got to put them on the full length when you get the big record deal, right?
You're pretty nice, thanks.
Well, no, Maury, you know, Maury's going to look at you, the A&R guy, and he's going to, look, Angie, if you don't put the Tide song on there, you know.
It's all over.
It's licensing, man. We can get more licenses on that. We'll get to the licensing in a second, because we can't go get away without doing that in this conversation.
It will be on the album.
It'll be on the album, which gives them something to look forward to.
Yeah, look forward to it, people. No.
Look forward, everybody.
No, I figure at some point that album's going to be available to people in a much larger way.
Oh, yeah.
And so I believe that, you know, it's something special
for
the people who came on.
Well, yeah, because in theory, only 1,500 people could, forgetting downloads and stuff, only like 1,500 people could own the song. You're doing a mini tour now with a few stops. You're doing Portland, Chicago, New York, and of course, Brooklyn. Because Brooklyn is not New York anymore. Brooklyn is a cool thing unto itself now that, you know, important people live there. And then Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is much hipper than physically playing in you know, in Boston.
Well,
we know
Cass seems a great club, so.
Yes, I know. And I went to grad school in Boston, so I know. But that costs money. Yeah. And I can't imagine, and I now know, as we said when you're walking in, you say, well, I'm getting on the plane. You're not doing all that in the van, because that would be a hell of a drive. So who's supporting all this rock and roll? Because that's, you know, most artists do the tour where they hop in the van and they traverse the country and,
well,
you know, and never stay in hotels and shower once every 3 weeks and
all
that.
And that was me 2 weeks ago, actually. I was on the road from the beginning of January. I went out to New York and I had some meetings and played a show. And then I came back and played in LA and then drove up the coast and across to Utah and then down through Arizona with a friend. We sort of did a co-bill, Daniel Ahern, who had a band called Illit. And that was exactly the kind of tour you're talking about. We actually took my car so we didn't have to rent a car. And we stayed at friends' houses every night. And I have to admit, I didn't take as many showers as I should have. And
Thank you for that special visual.
Yeah, hey, you know.
It is whatever it takes. Well, you know what? Let's skip because I'm very proud because this is probably the only interview you've done in the past 3 months that hasn't opened talking about the movie. So I figured
it's true.
I'd save
Thank
that.
You.
Save that. Well, yeah, because that's still relevant news because the DVD will come out and there'll be lots of royalties there, hopefully. But nevertheless, that placement on Grey's Anatomy is an example. A lot of these music supervisors, you know, are doing a good thing for rock and roll because it is one of the last. Being that nobody really is buying CDs, it's one of the last bastions where a million people can hear a track and say, oh, I like that. I'll go check out the artist. So I don't mind that kind of commercialism, not to mention that it's where the money is.
Well, yeah, and it's a way that, you know, it's amazing.
Licensing and merch are the two places that there's money,
you
know, and performing. There's no money in actually selling records anymore.
It's true. Yeah, and I think that music supervisors and these people, producers and editors on shows, they really love music, and so they want to find great new music.
They're not going to put crap on there despite what the networks would want them to.
I mean, well, you know, I think it's like a whole creative process and anything, you know, I'm sure that there's checks that things have to go through and people always get to have what they want. But it's also like these shows, I think, are collaborative processes. Would that be it? and that there's a lot of people making decisions. And so music supervisors are definitely great friends to musicians and bands because they do love music and they want to find good music. And they do really help artists and they do have money in their budgets to give artists. And so like one license can help a band record an album and go on tour in a way that they would have to sell, you know, X number of albums to ever even reap that amount of money. And then if they're independent, all that money goes to them or to, you know, to a little cut to their managers or whatnot. So it's pretty phenomenal the way that I think it's transformed things for independent musicians. And I feel really lucky. I feel really lucky that Alexandra Patsavas, the supervisor on Grey's Anatomy, and the people on that show happened to like my music. And they've done me the biggest service ever because they've helped me to continue to make music. They helped me to make an album, essentially, because they believed in something that I did.
All right. So here we go. Let's take a break and let's talk about Mr. Cox. Now, ironically enough, I saw you at the Great American Music Hall. I was there.
Oh, you did?
But I didn't see. But here's the backwards thing. I gave away tickets to the movie. What happened was that I saw you and John. I heard the music. And then I saw the movie the next day.
Oh.
So I had the role reversal of hearing your voice, hearing it, and then hearing it against the actress and all of that. So I had no idea we'd be sitting here today when I saw you at the Great American as I was just laughing my ass off. So the project came to you from Michael Andrews.
Yeah, Michael Andrews, the composer on that
and you're
movie.
On three songs in the movie, but did I only see one of them on the soundtrack, or am I mistaken, or are they all on the soundtrack?
I think...
on the actual physical soundtrack.
Three are on the soundtrack, but I'm doing more of a real backing vocal on two of them, so I think...
So you're credited on
Let's
one of them.
Let's Duet is the one that they really credited me on as the hit. As a featured vocalist.
Now, Dewey didn't try anything on you, did he? Because being the guy he is, did he?
Well,
we have to do the NME Us Magazine thing here.
You know, what goes on between me and Mr. Cox is really our business.
But what was it?
You just can't help but throw those double entendres on there.
Yeah, well, and he got it. There's only one joke in the movie, and it just goes on and on and on. But
it's
the
Cox joke over and over.
Yeah, but it is very funny. And I've seen, because I'm also in the film end of things, I've seen John C. Reilly at a lot of parties and stuff, and he's an enigma as a human being because he's always the guy in the corner that no one's really, up until probably, you know, this little starring role, you know, he's always the guy in the corner that nobody's talking to, and he's just hanging out and he's observing the scene. So what was it? Was he an enigma to work with, too? I mean, you worked with him in character, so that must have, but you also worked with him out of character,
yeah,
I would imagine.
A little bit. You know, he really, he's such a really gentle, humble, kind man.
Right.
And he is really soft-spoken. So it was funny to actually then see him transition into being Dewey Cox when he was not in character. I almost felt shy about talking to him because I didn't want to, you know, disturb him. It seemed like he was in his thoughts and sort of just, you know. So it was totally surreal, though, to hear my voice in this huge theater and see this beautiful woman, Jenna Fischer, and, you know, John C. Reilly singing to the track that I worked on one evening in a studio in Glendale with some friends.
So before we play some music, we've invented a thing called a musical sandwich.
Okay.
And what it is two of your songs is the bread and then songs by other artists that you've always wanted to play on the radio in between.
Really?
And that's how people will be informed of what your musical taste is and what got you to what you're playing.
I was thinking of playing Racing Tides for you.
Well, you don't get to leave the room if you don't.
Okay.
That's a moral obligation as far as I'm concerned.
And I don't know, how many songs do you want me to play?
Well, two or three, but let's pick the two that'll be the bread, and then we can fill in a session song to open the to open the show.
So how about I'll play Racing Tides, and I'll play a song called Nightlight.